Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know, I have in my hands a book called The Importance of Living by Lin Yutang. Those of you who have listened to my show since 94 understand the charm of this man, which I discovered when I was 18, and I thought, oh, life is horrible, you know, oh, it's me, I can't take it anymore. And then I found this book, The Importance of Living, where he brought the yin and yang together. He taught me that we are basically, although we have a soul, that we're monkeys. Our bodies are that of a monkey. I mean, I know many of you are offended by that, but truthfully, you know, it's been put another way, that we're the Neanderthal diet. But you got to remember that the human body is that of an animal. And that's where all your trouble begins. Anyway, this book put me together because there were chapters in it like, let me give you an example. Lin Yutang, The Importance of Living. But I never saw a book like this which talked about views of mankind, Christian, Greek, and Chinese, our animal heritage, the monkey epic, on being mortal, on having a stomach, on having strong muscles, on having a mind, and on human dignity and the rise of human civilization. Then he goes into enjoyment of life. That's what I'm getting at. And he talks about whole chapters on sex, on celibacy, a freak of civilization. My favorite chapter was The Enjoyment of Living, on lying in bed. A whole chapter on lying in bed, on sitting in chairs, on conversation, on tea and friendship, on smoke and incense, on drink and wine games, on food and medicine, the inhumanity of Western dress, on house and interiors. And I remember I read this when I was 18 years old, which goes back quite a few decades. And when I first stumbled upon it, I was astounded by this. And it was a combination of sort of our animal bodies with our spiritual beings. In a way, I had never been able to unify the two. You know, kids grow up, they don't know what they are. Either you run too much in one direction or too much in the other. Either you become too much of the spiritual and you try to deny the body, or you become too much of the animal, you know, the pleasure seeker, and you deny your spirit. And this book, for me, brought it all together. And one of the favorite parts for me was Chin's 33 Happy Moments. And I don't know if the people listening to this show, since I'm in a sort of different mood today and I had enough with Obama, this stuff was good stuff. And it was the happy moments of a Chinese as described by a 17th century playwright in China named Chin Shengtan. And he wrote about, he sat with his friends when they were locked up in a temple for 10 days on account of rainy weather, and they thought about what were the truly happy moments of human life, moments in which the spirit is tied up with the senses. And he writes about them, and I'm not going to read all of them to you. I'm going to give you a taste of some of them, and you'll see if you get a kick out of them. Here's one. See if it strikes you as a happy moment in your life. I wake up in the morning and seem to hear someone in the house sighing and saying that last night someone died. I immediately ask to find out who it is and learn that it is the sharpest, most calculating fellow in town. Ah, is this not happiness? Remember this? Remember he wrote that happiness does not consist in the flights of poets, of that kind of thing, but happiness consists in getting your hair cut every 2 weeks and watching your neighbor fall off the roof? That's what I was trying to talk about. In other words, that's human nature, is this normalcy. And also, if you get pleasure in seeing someone you hate fall off a roof, don't be guilty about it. Everyone likes to see their evil neighbor fall off a roof. Here's another one. Wait. It has been raining for a whole month, and I lie in bed in the morning like one drunk or ill, refusing to get up. First of all, that unto itself is beautiful. We work so damn hard in America. We never lay in bed. We think it's bad for our hearts. The opposite is true. I'm a big believer in laying in bed. I believe that laying in bed is way underestimated. I think we're just crazy with our running and our dashing and our this and our that. Anyway, listen to this one. It has been raining for a whole month, and I lie in bed in the morning like one drunk or ill, refusing to get up. Suddenly, I hear a chorus of birds announcing a clear day. Quickly, I pull aside the curtain, push open the window, and see the beautiful sun shining and glistening, and the forest looks like having a bath. Ah, is this not happiness? Okay? Let's see then. Here's another. A few more. It's so disconnected from today. Here, I love this one. To cut with a sharp knife a bright green watermelon on a big scarlet plate of a summer afternoon. Ah, is this not happiness? You get the picture? In other words, can you see a watermelon on a hot day and just cutting it and get pleasure out of it? That's what he's talking about. We've lost this. We think that because the ad men have so jumbled our brains, the madmen, the advertising, that we have to go somewhere to find happiness. We have to buy something to find happiness. We all know that that's rubbish. I've long wanted to become a monk, but was worried because I would not be permitted to eat meat. If then I could be permitted to become a monk and yet eat meat publicly, why then I would heat a basin of hot water and with the help of a sharp razor shave my head clean in a summer month. Ah, is this not happiness? To keep three or four spots of eczema in a private part of my body and now and then to scald or bathe it with hot water behind closed doors. Ah, is this not happiness? I mean, does this translate well anymore? I mean, I love this book. It reminds you how simple things are. I love this one. Wait. A traveler returns home after a long journey, and he sees the old city gate and hears the women and children on both banks of the river talking his own dialect. Ah, is this not happiness? Now, let's say we don't have an old city gate, and we don't have our own dialect, or do we? We certainly do have regional accents. How about when you've been on a long business trip, and you come back to your city or your town, and just the sound of the horns and just the sound of the cab driver, even if he's from Bengali, even if he is a Bengali, isn't that what makes you feel good and at home and happy? That's what we're talking about. Here's a nice one. I am not a saint, and I am therefore not without sin. In the night, I did something wrong, and I get up in the morning and feel extremely ill at ease. I am not a saint, and I'm therefore not without sin. In the night, I did something wrong, and I get up in the morning and feel extremely ill at ease about it. Suddenly, I remember what is taught by Buddhism, that not to cover one's sins is the same as repentance. So then I begin to tell my sin to the entire company around, whether they are strangers or my old friends. Ah, is this not happiness? Sort of sounds like Oprah. Here's one that I've really lived by. This is me. To open the window and let a wasp out of the room. Ah, is this not happiness? That's a good one. Have you ever let a wasp out of a room or a fly and felt something? Huh? I have. I've done that. To see someone's kite line broken. Ah, is this not happiness? To see a wild prairie fire, ah, is this not happiness? To have just finished repaying all one's debts, ah, is this not happiness, Obama? Now, if he went to China and said, I'm finished repaying my debts, by the way, see if you can collect it, then I would say I would love the guy. If he could go to China and say, you know what, let me tell you something. We owe you a couple of $1 trillion. We ain't paying you. We can't pay you. You're never going to collect. But I'm willing to negotiate right now 10 cents on the dollar. Then I would say, ah, is this not happiness?
Savage.
I have a couple of things I want to tell you about. A, how I just survived coffee at a Starbucks in San Francisco. This took the patience of Job.
I was wrong to try to love you.
Before the show, I went down. I got to go buy coffee and see how you people suffer, fools, ungladly. Just before the show, I ran out for a Starbucks. Now, I survived Starbucks. It's not easy, I got to tell you. I'm in a rush. It's like, 20 minutes before the show. I should have sent someone out for it, but I tend to work alone. I like to be alone. I ran out for a coffee. I figured I could sneak in at that time, though. And bingo, I hit three people ahead of me, and a girl jumps in ahead of me. and the three people, everyone's cute. And what kind of the suite do you want? I think, and there were men, and everyone was with a cute, no one would say, just give me the blueberry cake or give me the oatmeal cookie. Everything was like with a cutesy thing. Oh, I think I'll have the, oh, you're such a sweetie pie. All right, so I had to live through them. The feet were curling up inside the shoe on that one. I don't say anything. So now there's only one in front of me. And did I hit the lottery with her? I figured she looked normal. She was going to say, coffee and get out of there. But no, here it was. I'll have a double grande latte espresso decaf with extra low-fat cream and extra foam and a soy blast sprinkle, please. I'm not making this up. I said, no. Now I'm getting enraged inside. My eyes are already searching to take it out on something. Again, she repeated. The guy didn't even know what she said. That's right. And a sweet voice on it. I'll have a double grande latte espresso decaf with extra low-fat cream and extra foam and a soy blast sprinkle, please. And then, to top it off, after the guy makes it for her, she pulls out a coupon. Prior to surviving Starbucks, I did something even more threatening to my psyche, which was I went to Fisherman's Wharf. I got into the city early, so I went by bicycle to Fisherman's Wharf. I haven't been there for a year. I stopped going for about a year. I went once this year. And I went and had a bowl of clam chowder soup and some joint near the water. The guy gave me a bowl of cornstarch with the droppings of a clam in it. I don't know how they didn't get arrested for this. How do they sell this on Fisherman's Wharf? Then the nerve of this mutt, he says to me, do you want a cup or a bowl? I was in a rush. I was on the phone. I said, give me a cup. The cup was $5.95. A bowl would have been a dollar more. I paid and left. I didn't care. But the point was the soup was garbage. How do they serve this to tourists? With it was like cornstarch with the essence of a squeezed clam in it? But the schmucks don't know what they're eating. That's why they call it the Redneck Riviera. You should see the blimps walking around down there. You know, you should see the average American. I don't know what they have in their brains. IQ average, 65 after a fish meal. They walk into cars. They walk in front of cable cars like blimps floating around. Stuffed, stupid, morons. You can push them in any direction you want. So I'm bicycling back past two U.S. warships from World War II, the Jeremiah O'Brien and the USS Pomponito, a U.S. submarine from World War II. You marvel at it. 120 men were in that thing in World War II. If you were to take that ship today and look at the average fat, obese, disgusting American tourist walking on Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, A, you couldn't get more than 18 of them into that submarine. B, you'd have to sue the Navy under the ADA to have them blowtorch open the hatches to get them in and out. Every time I encounter anything outside the house, it's a problem. Who serves a man a bowl of clam chowder soup that is made primarily of cornstarch and the essence of a clam and charges them $6.95? They're lucky that I didn't say anything to them. I went there like invisible to see what it would be like if I were a tourist. But they don't know what they're eating. They're drunk, most of them. You put a glass of wine in them, a cheap glass of rotgut wine. They get giddy. What do they know what they are? Play Staying Alive by the Bee Gees.
I see John Travolta with Bell Bottom doing disco in the aisles of a 747 with his friends from Scientology, meeting their God as they fly across the Earth's atmosphere, discoing into the next universe. I think I had one pair of bell bottoms. They made you feel so free, didn't they? Didn't they give you a sense of freedom, those velvet bell bottoms? I don't know. I wish I could say what I really meant on this show. What needs to be done. Wish I could really let it out. One day, just open up the 12 cylinders inside my soul. Right now, I'm running on about 6, 7. If I could really pour gas down those cylinders, I could give you an action plan that would have you alerted, alive. You'd feel alive you haven't felt, like you haven't felt in 30 years. I could bring this country to a halt. I could change things in 2 days. But instead, I will just play disco music. Play it a little louder, please. Louder, louder. Picture all of the truckers. Picture every independent trucker in America blocking every tunnel and every bridge in America to say enough is enough to the Congress and the oil companies. Just envision that. You want to have a vision? Let's start with the basics. One day, one strike like in France, where every independent trucker closes down every bridge and every tunnel in the United States of America. You want to see those liars and rats in Congress finally do something instead of pointing fingers at each other? You want to see the Seven Sister Oil Companies go to prison? Hey, play, staying alive. Yeah, play, staying alive. Go ahead. I'm not recommending this, of course. That's plan of action number one for today in the fantasy land of the Savage Nation. But we're just doing disco. Disco on the Savage Nation. Staying alive. Staying alive. But I have a dream. I have a dream that one day I'll awaken to every bridge and tunnel in America blocked by the independent truckers of America who say, up yours, Johnson. Up yours, Jack. You've jacked us up. You've killed us. You brought in drivers from Mexico. You've undermined us and killed us. Up yours, Jack. All you corporate CEOs, here's the middle finger from the truck driver. How's that for step one to take back America on the Savage Nation? Staying alive, staying alive. Staying alive, staying alive. Step number one, fantasy in the Savage Nation. A fantasy in the Savage Nation. We become France. France becomes us. The workers go on strike. The real workers, not the illegal alien workers. Strike for illegal things. No, the legitimate American truck driver. He blocks every bridge and every tunnel and every artery in America stops. The country comes to a halt. No food, no garbage, no fuel, nothing in, nothing out. Suddenly the CEO crooks, the pirates in business suits. They can't do the two-step. Suddenly the thieves and criminals in Congress who point fingers to deceive us can no longer do the two-step. I'll be right back. Keep on dreaming, Mike.
Savage.
Eddie, my love, I love you so. I want it for you. You'll never know.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Don't make me wait.
Now we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. Raleigh, North Carolina. Tiffany, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Savage. Just calling to let you know that I really enjoy listening to your show.
That's all? That's the whole thing?
No, that's not the whole thing.
Give me the whole thing. Give me the whole shot.
I enjoy listening to your show. I happen to learn a lot when I'm listening to your show.
And oh, that's nice. I do. I try to bring a little more than I have to, you know, because otherwise people would find it boring unless you give them a little poetry, a little learning, a little sign. Yeah, I bet you go away feeling you learned a little, like you were a little bit in school, but in a fun way.
Yeah, in a fun and crazy kind of way. I wish you wouldn't get so upset, though, because I declare I have to turn because I'm thinking you're going to fall out on the radio.
No, I worry about it myself, too, Tiffany. Sometimes I say, you know, at night I can't sleep. It's I get so worked up over these issues like immigration and diseases, I go crazy. And then I get agitated to the point where I worry myself. I say, what are you, nuts? You're going to wind up dying here. The last thing that... Your fear, Tiffany, is that one day I'm going to be screaming and yelling, and this is the last thing you're going to hear. And I'll tell you! That's your fear, is the mic goes over and I'm finished. Peter on WRKO, you're on the Savage Nation.
Franklin Roosevelt saved England and basically Europe, not Churchill.
Okay. So what is it you're arguing about, FDR? What part of this argument am I missing?
Well, you're missing the fact that you tout Churchill as the great leader that in certain instances was, but he could stand there and make the speech that we will fight on the beaches and so on and so forth. But if FDR did not...
All right, well, let's take one person at a time. Churchill was the spiritual or intellectual leader of the English people. He tried to warn them through the 1930s. They wouldn't listen to him. During the war, they did listen to him, and he gave them the courage to fight. Admittedly, it was the Lend-Lease deal and the American troops who saved England. But are you arguing, therefore, that because FDR was a liberal, that only a liberal can save America?
excuse me, FDR was a progressive Democrat, and if you are
He was a progressive Democrat. So are you arguing that the internment of the Japanese by this progressive Democrat was a liberal policy that you would support?
I'm not discussing Japan. I'm discussing the fact that...
Wait, sir, you just said that FDR was a progressive Democrat and that he saved the West during World War II. So I'm asking you, which of the progressive Democrats' policies is it that you are offering us as an example today? Is it the internment of the Japanese?
Nope, I'm talking about the fact of the Second World War and beginning before the Second World War.
Well, sir, wait a minute. You cannot separate and take away individual acts of FDR and say that those were exceptions. Didn't he pass an executive order to intern the Japanese?
Absolutely. But if you
Does that make him a progressive Democrat? Or does that tell us that in times of war, the progressive politics that you seem to be a fan of may have to be put on hold?
Again, I'm not going to discuss that. If you want to end the call, fine. I want to talk about...
Why do you mean you won't discuss it? Is that because you can't or you won't?
No, I won't. How's that?
Well, why not? Tell me why you will not discuss the internment of the Japanese, since you're glorifying FDR and you're saying it's his liberalism that saved the West. But I'm asking you if his acts during World War II, of which there were many, including the internment of the Japanese, were liberal acts or were they actually conservative acts?
They were acts at the time that probably were warranted, but hindsight, Monday morning quarterback, showed that they would not have been done if people were not concerned with a so-called imminent attack by the Japanese on our West Coast. Okay?
I'm missing the point. So let's look at some of the... You don't want to talk about the internment of the Japanese by this progressive Democrat. So let's talk about some of the other acts of FDR during World War II that certainly don't exhibit any kind of progressive... they're not of a progressive liberal nature. They were very clearly conservative in nature. Many of his acts were conservative in nature. So during the war, he was able to put aside his socialism and his tendencies toward liberalism and move to save America. So I don't see where you and I have to argue over this.
Yeah, we do have to argue over it because of the fact that the way you tout Churchill with regard to basically saving England is a lot of horse feathers because it took...
So you're arguing now that Churchill's work in the 1930s was to no avail? He single-handedly built up the British armaments industry. What are you talking about?
Look, if it wasn't...
He was fought by men like you who were appeasers who said... Germany does not threaten us. We don't need to build up our Navy. We don't need to build up our Air Force. It was because of Churchill that they built the Spitfire plane during the 1930s. It was because of Churchill that they built up the Royal Navy, that they had a military. So how can you argue he had no effect upon the war?
And in our country, we had so-called conservative Republicans that said, this fight is not ours. Europe's war is not ours. You don't remember that, but if you read history, you would have seen that.
Don't lecture me about history because you read one book. Your points do not make sense. What you're trying to argue is that we need a progressive leader to save us in this battle against Islamofascism. But I'm willing to bet that you won't even identify Islamofascism as the threat, will you? But what happened to you? You went deaf, dumb, and blind all of a sudden? Where do you stand on the threat from Osama bin Laden and the Islamofascists? Do you say it doesn't exist, it does exist, or what?
No, I don't want to even get into that.
What do you want to get into? Why are you wasting my time? Go back to one of your communist halls down there in Boston and give yourself the malarkey and then have a scotch on me. You're living in the past, my friend. You're an old trade unionist who doesn't even know what the hell you're talking about anymore.
Conflict of interest in discussing all of this, too.
You don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea what Muslim crusade that is going on around the world. How can we even have a discussion?
No, I understand what the threat is.
So what do we argue with? Then why are you and I, two good Americans, fighting? Why are we fighting with each other?
The threat is, okay, I understand what the threat is, but I'm...
So then why are you and I, where are we disagreeing? I don't even understand what the disagreement is.
My disagreement is with you're touting Churchill at every time I listen to you, and I do listen to you because it's entertainment, not fact, but entertainment.
That's right. In other words, you liberals are the only ones who have brains. We have no brains, the conservatives. We entertain you. The reason you're listening to me is that inside you, there's a man who can still live and stand up and understand reality. The man who wants to overcome and break free of the shackles of liberalism. That's why you're listening to me. I'm not entertaining you. I'm educating you, Peter.
No, not me. If you look at the people that have taken us through wars, from the First World War, through the Second World War, through Korea, through Vietnam, were all Democrat presidents.
So what are you saying, that the Democrats are the party of war?
Fanatical, radical...
Wait a minute. Are you saying that the Democrats are the party of militancy and war?
No, I'm saying that the Democrats...
Oh, wait, you just said that. I agree with you. It has been Democrats who've taken us to war. Absolutely, I agree with you. So what's your point? That they're a militant party of war? Well, then I would gladly become a Democrat if they were still a party willing to stand up for America, but they're not. They become a sort of European socialist party of appeasers. They're not that party that you're talking about. I would gladly join a party that was still a JFK, FDR-type party. They disappeared a long time ago, Peter. I think you're living in another world.
No, they didn't disappear. They're there. They are there.
What about my statement that in 1933, did you hear that piece or you missed that?
Which one?
The year that the Nazis came to power. The Oxford Union, which is a debating society where all of the future British political elite would debate, they passed a resolution that said this House would under no circumstances fight for its king and country. That you and I would agree, I think, that that's appeasement, wouldn't you?
You got to remember the Germans. You got to remember your history. The Germans. And
well, sir, wait. Don't speak down to me. Don't talk down to me because I'll throw you off my show. This is my bar, not yours. You got to remember your history. And you got to remember that I'm far more educated than you are.
Well, yeah, that's why they didn't accept you into Berkeley. You remember how much you were.
Excuse me, sir. Hello. I earned my PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. What are you talking about? Just what are you talking about?
I never applied
for anything but admission to the PhD program, and I got my PhD in 3 years, sir, with a 3.94 a GPA, whatever they call it. Out of a 4.0. Can you match those credentials, sir?
What about the time you applied for...
Well, no. You see, again, you're a classic weasel. Every time you lose a point, you change the argument. You can't win one point with me, so you keep going to the next point. But I got news for you. You're fighting a futile battle.
You're absolutely
1933,
right.
The Nazis come to power. The Oxford Union, a liberal debating society, says we, this House... would under no circumstances fight for its king and country. That is appeasement. You know that, and I know that. How did Hitler take it? He said, well, the British would never fight another war with Germany. He became emboldened. It's identical to what your leader, Nancy Pelosi, is doing with the Islamo-fascists. I'm ashamed at you, sir, because you probably were one day, at one time in your life, an educated, intelligent man.
Savage.
See the girl with the red dress song. She can do the burlap all night long. Yeah, yeah. What I say.
Now here's a true childhood story that I may have told once in 15 years of radio. Barry Schmaltz and his crazy mother Betty Schmaltz and his father Louis Schmaltz. The names have been changed to protect the Schmaltzes. Let's see. How do I begin the story? He was about 15 years old. He was a tall kid. His bedroom, pink carpet, two-story house, nice house. He's having a fist fight with his father in the bedroom over something his mother said. It ends with him crying and enraged because he knew he could beat the heck out of his father after a few real good punches were thrown. I don't know if you've ever seen a father and son fight. It's actually heartbreaking to see. To me, it was a violation of a very deeply held taboo, never to strike your father no matter what. Well, I don't know, but that family was crazy from top to bottom. They went at each other with straight rights and blasted each other, and it ended with the kid holding his punches because I think he could have really knocked his father on his butt. He picked up a piggy bank that to me was like, looked like a 25-pound piggy bank that he had, a ceramic one, since I knew him for 10 years. And he was enraged and red-faced and tears running down his eyes. He looked at his father, and he smashed the piggy bank on the floor, and all the coins that he had collected since childhood was smashed. And then the father threw him out of the house, and he wound up living in my mother's in our basement for a little while. Now, I don't know this guy anymore, but let me tell you what happened that day. Here's what happened that day. His mother was a would-be, like, movie star, as many women were in the 50s. They were always trying to be like either not Marilyn Monroe, but there were some buxom movie like Jane Mansfield, more like that type. Cadillac, the platinum blonde hair, always showing off. The father was a worker, gray-faced. He'd come home gray-faced from his job. He owned a little wholesale milk business. So they were a little better off than us somehow. But she had the Cadillac, the Coupe de Ville, pink one. And a whack job, nuts, out of her mind. Why? She was always trying to lose weight. She went to some doctor in New Jersey who put her on Benzedrine or some kind of amphetamines, which gave her a madness, a Benny high. And so she comes home crazy out of her mind, and she takes a dog chain, and a dog chain, and beats her wrist till it bleeds just before the father comes in at dusk, ashen-faced from the day in the milk plant, and she says, Louie, look what your rotten son did to me. Look what he did to my hands. Well, Louie, the father, naturally would be protective of his wife. He runs upstairs and screams to the kid, Barry, what did you do to your mother? And the kid says, I didn't do anything. You liar, you. And that's when they fought. And that's when it happened. That's when the piggy bank. So from the crazy mother, Betty Schmaltz, who turned Louie against Barry. Now, you say drug usage is prevalent today. Let me tell you something. There's plenty of drug usage in those glorious Eisenhower days, but it was sub rosa drug usage. Half the women were either on Miltown or on Benzedrine for diet. Miltown was as popularly prescribed then as Prozac, let's say, is today. You know, a lot of kids came home from college and used a little Miltown with rosé wine, Meduse rosé. They got a nice buzzeroo during the afternoons when the mother wasn't home. So I'm telling you, that's the Schmaltz story. It's a sad story. And the kid wound up basically a bug all his life. He was never stable. Well, I haven't seen him in many years, but he was a good friend of mine, but he's not a reliable friend because when a kid can't rely upon his mother or his father, he winds up to be an unreliable person in life 99% of the time. He winds up to be someone you can't count on because he can never count on somebody else. Right after the show, I'm racing over to the yacht harbor to go out on my boat. So during the break, I called and I ordered two pizzas. I have a friend who's going to bring the pizza to the boat. So I said, "So she bothered me. She said, what kind of pizza? I said, I'm on a break. I don't know anything. I said, I know sausage and pepper and onion. I said, no, I can't. I said, Teddy's kosher. I said, he can't have sausage. It was funny. She laughed. I said, he's Hillel, not Halal. That's a joke unto itself, but it's like for a very, very small number of people. From Hillel to Halal in one generation. You know what I find amazing is that Halal food is actually kosher food. This is the good news, is that moderate Muslims actually eat Jewish food. Thank God. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same kosher food laws. There's got to be some way to build on that. If a Muslim who's not fanatic can eat a kosher food that the rabbi certifies the chicken, you know, was circumcised or whatever it is, that the cow didn't go to a bathhouse, the normal cow had a husband, had a baby, then got slaughtered, boom, and he'll eat it. And they could both eat the same cow and the same chicken and then the milk and the meat and the flesh and the poultry and no winged creatures and no hoof creatures and no flying creatures with big eyes and no feelers if they go out in the right way, the wrong way, the feeler is this, then you can't eat it. It's the same rules. It comes from the Old Testament. There's got to be a way to build understanding here between Jews and Muslims. You start with the halal and kosher thing. Maybe there's a way to save the world here. You can't eat a crawling creature that crawls backwards on its belly, but you can eat a crawling creature that flies on Mondays between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern Time. God. You ever read those rules? They're very complicated. Most of us can't even live up to the Big Ten. just thou shalt not steal. Forget about it. You're already looking for a clause. Well, I don't steal, but sometimes I have to take. That's not stealing. It's like Paris Hilton. It's L.A. I do not steal, but it's I hear you on that. But I took something that wasn't mine, but it wasn't really theirs either. And because I'm in L.A., I hear you when I was caught and released in 3 days. Take another rule on the Big Ten that's impossible for me to follow. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, I don't commit adultery because the person I did it with wasn't married. I may be married, but they weren't. So technically, if you look at it from a biblical point of view, that's not adultery. That's just having a good time, and the girl was single, and she knew I was married, and she wanted the money, so who's it bothering? Nobody. Wasn't adultery. All right. Everything is a clause and an out and a twist. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ass, his house, his mouse, his clock. The mouse ran up the clock. I don't covet. I only want it. How does it differ with the want from covet? I don't exactly know, but I know that covetousness is horrible. It is biblically detestable. So I never covet. I only want that which I take. So what I'm saying is we can't even live up to the Big Ten most of the time. Lie, cheat, steal. But now you take religious Jews and religious Muslims. They got like 300, or the religious Jews have 333 commandments. No wonder they're praying all day long. They're praying for forgiveness. Because all day long they're breaking a commandment. They got to be. They didn't touch the fringe properly. The fringe was blue and white, but not exactly the right blue. They prayed forward instead of backwards. The head moved. It's so complicated. And that's why you have to pray all day long if you have 333 rules, because no doubt you're breaking the rules somewhere. Even when you're sleeping, you broke a rule. The first thing you do when you wake up is say, God, forgive me for breaking a rule in the middle of the night. I touched myself below the belt. I didn't mean to. But I was asleep. It was unconscious. It was subconscious. It wasn't me. It was Harry did it. I didn't really do it. There's an evil spirit in me named Harry. Harry reached down below the belt. I didn't mean to. He did. You should punish him. Don't punish me. But since we're in the same body, I understand you, God. I forgive you. God says, you don't have to forgive me, man. I'm the big guy. I'm in charge. Well, I forgive you anyway. Don't say it again, because then you're really going to get punished.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. The sound and fury quote from Shakespeare's Macbeth. He's talking about the ephemeral nature of life and how brief it is. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I think many of us feel this and don't talk about it. We take the Prozac. We take the psychic Prozac called television, or the psychic Prozac called football or baseball or basketball or rap music or whatever it may be, or the crack or the cocaine or the marijuana or the alcohol or whatever it may be, or the running. And you can get very, very cynical about it all and say, what's the point of trying if it's all a charade and we're going to die anyway? You know, that's depressing. And there are many answers to that question that are life-affirming. There are many reasons to go on. I learned so much in my childhood, I didn't even know I was learning it. That's the beautiful part of it. In that sense, I would say I had a very rich childhood because so much was seen and heard and overheard. And I look back now, look, here's a story I told maybe once for 2 seconds relating to the ephemeral nature of life and how you can really go down, you know, off the deep end if you look at this the wrong way and you don't have the right spiritual or emotional support. There was a woman in the neighborhood in Queens, attached houses. I can't get any more detailed.
the attached houses, which to us was a gigantic step up. It was like the Queen's Palace from where I had come from, a little green yard. And one of the neighbors in the block, he was really high class because he was a doctor. So he had a wife who had a nervous breakdown, so-called. I don't even think they use the phrase anymore, nervous breakdown. I don't even know what it is. What happened was she stayed at home all day, and she wandered the streets of Queens, or that neighborhood, and she would take people's arms and say, what's the meaning of living if we're only going to die? Now, she had two children, and the other women didn't know what to say to her. She could not understand why she should live if only she was going to die. Then she would say, but my children are also born to die. I mean, that spooked out a lot of the women in the neighborhood, so they stopped talking to her. Now, maybe she was, in her own way, touching upon the Sound and Fury quote from Shakespeare of tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And haven't you seen that picture? And how did you get past that? What gives you the reason to struggle and go on? Why do you struggle? You ever look at your children and say, they're too going to fade like dust, ashes to ashes and dust to dust? And yes, we all get those thoughts if we're you. When you look at your pet, your fish, your dog, your cat, you know, I got a box upstairs with ashes in it. I got a mother and a father and a brother in a grave and a grandmother and grandfather and ancestors in graves, as you do. We all do. And yet, you know, it's a strange society. We never talk about death in that way. All we talk about is victimhood and suffering and how everyone's a victim. But do we really talk about the meaning of life and the meaning of death, or only about death as an opposite to life, meaning you're no longer a consumer? See, once you die, you're of no use to the Murdochs and the Morlocks and the meatheads who need you as a consumer, an idiot to watch or an idiot to buy. In other words, a consumer. If you're dead, you're no longer a good consumer, except perhaps you can still buy a casket from one of these operations. Perhaps they'll figure out a way to sell you a conservative casket or a liberal casket with an inscription on it. It's probably not a bad business, where they now start monogramming caskets or something. But what motivates me to go on, for example? How do I do this every day? Why do I do this anymore? I don't really need the income. My children are grown. They're doing very well. I have enough to, you know, basically retire on. I could have retired a long time ago. Why do I do this? You'll have to ask yourself, why am I not as desperate to sell you something as some men are who are younger with young children? And I understand why they have to peddle and they have to sell you and they have to con you day and night to sell you another item or another. I understand it. They're younger than me by probably 20 years, many of them, and they haven't made their fortune or their marks, and they're very insecure about that. So they continue to sell you things that you don't really need. So therefore, if I'm not really selling you anything, what is it that motivates me every day? Well, it's an obligation to God primarily. I know you say, well, who is he kidding? What, are you kidding me? Take it for what it is. I don't really care whether you believe me or not. I know I mean every word I just said to you. You see, I was ruined in life several times, primarily by liberalism. Liberalism destroyed me, or almost destroyed me, and almost put me into the grave. The liberals, through affirmative action, stole my birthright. They took it from me. They turned me into a nun person. And they said that less qualified women and less qualified minorities only need apply. And they said, you shall not apply, even though you are a white male, you're of no value whatsoever, to our new America. Well, it was tough for me to bear. And had I let it get to me, I would have died or never struggled again. But I told you what happened. I told you how it happened, and it's amazing. It was a certain time in my life, and it was about 16 years ago. And everything had gone bad for me because of affirmative action and because of a few scoundrels in the vitamin business, ruthless gonoffs of the lowest order. Things had gone really bad for me, and I wanted to give up. I really did. Well, my son, we were living in and this is an interesting story in a way. I had to move back to a house that I had purchased, a small house that I had purchased a few years before as a rental unit. And things had gotten so bad, I had to move into my own rental unit. And it wasn't a happy time for us. The children were still teenagers, blah, blah, blah. So I was sitting in this dark little horrendous room that I called a study, which was really a converted nursery. It was disgusting, with a little tiny window. There was nothing, there was no nobility in it whatsoever. It was a complete failure. And this was after a PhD, two master's degrees, 16 books. No matter what I did, it was like I had dug for oil. I was like a wildcatter, and 1,000 wells had come up dry. I said, I'm not doing this anymore. So I called my son in, who was a teenager, And I said, son, I'm not going to work anymore. I'm going to retire because I there's no point to this. Well, he said to me, you can't retire. He said, that's giving up. He said, men retire at 65. I got so pissed off at him, I chased him out of the room and I ran after him down the block. And you know what? Because of that, I was embarrassed. And for him, I had to get off my behind, get out of the gutter, and I had to struggle again. That's when I created the tape, the first radio tape. So help me God. A few months later, I created the mock radio tape and sent it out to 400 stations. And the rest is really history. That turned me around. But, you know, it was based upon a lot of prayer and a lot of thought and family. Family keeps us together. So having said that, I had only asked God for one thing. During the darkest moments of my failures, or really I should say the failures of our society, which took some of the most talented white men in history and put them on the shelf in order to promote people who were less qualified simply to make people feel better and in order to introduce socialism to America at a faster pace, I said to God, all I ask you for is to give me a living. I beg you not for riches. I beg you not for fame. I beg you only for a living. Well, I now have a very good living in talk radio and as a writer. But you see, it came with a burden. Remember I told you that God answered my prayers, but there's always something attached to his answer? He didn't say, here, go, you're going to win the lottery. Because if he had said, here, because you suffered so much, my son, put $4 on number 933B7, and you're going to win $90 million in fastball or something. Well, I probably would have blown my head off by now if I had won some kind of lottery. I'm a worker. I was raised to work. I'm going to work until probably I can't work anymore. And it's because I was raised this way. It's in my genes. My father, to him, the most important value in a boy was working. Every time he mocked me, it was because I was too lazy or I wasn't working hard enough. And the way he mocked me is he would say to his friends when I was a little boy in his store, look at this, look at the worker I have for a son. He's a real hard worker, isn't he? And the other men would say, oh, come on, leave him alone. He's not a bad kid. He'll be a good worker. And my father would look at me and sarcastically say, yeah, look at the worker I have. Always dozing off or something to that effect. So to him, work was a great value. It's almost laughable in this hedonistic age that we live in where work is considered de classe. Well, I know that there are many men who have much less than I do financially, who are retired. And good luck to you if you are, and I understand it. But I'm not made that way. I wouldn't know what to do with myself from the beginning of the day to the end. I wouldn't know how to spend my time. Now, maybe that's sad. Maybe it is sad that I don't know how to enjoy myself on a golf course or a tennis court. It is possible, but it's not in my genes. I did not learn how to play golf. I learned how to sled on a cobblestone street in the Bronx. I did not learn how to ski. And when I went to college, there were kids even in Queens College or working college who were going to ski lifts and skiing. I'm not a skier. I didn't understand the fun of skiing. And I know those who do. In fact, when my children were very young, I took them skiing. I taught them how to ski. I figured it's a great American sport. And I admire those who can really ski. But when I have gone to the mountains in the last few years during ski season, I don't want to ski. It's a zoo. It's a zoo. It looks like a bunch of automatons. Clankety, 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 clank. Line them up. Here they come. Take them up, shoot them down. Get them drunk at night. Take them up, shoot them down. Get them drunk at night. Take them up, shoot them down. Clankety, clank, clankety, clank. Where's the beauty in that? I used to go to the High Sierras and I used to walk in the winter. I used to snow walk. I don't do it anymore. You know why? Because of yahoos on snowmobiles. I won't even walk in the woods anymore. Do I want to listen to a putt shooting by on a snowmobile? Shooting out dirty, ugly fumes on a snowfield that I used to walk on in the absolute silence. Did you ever hear the silence of a snowfield? Can you still hear it? The whoosh and the hiss of snow and sound? America has become a gigantic noise cesspool. There's almost nowhere to go anymore for any peace and quiet. Every neighborhood. There's not a neighborhood in America that is affluent and beautiful that you can live in any peace. Because everyone is greedier than his neighbor. I think I'll put in marble. I think I'll put in granite. I think I'll put in granite. I think I'll put in granite. I'll put in granite and I'll flip it and I'll make money and I'll screw the next person. Everyone's suddenly Donald Trump. Everyone's a Donald Trump, and from morning till night, every house is being renovated. Every house is being redone. You can't even live in your own houses anymore. So tell me where to go to get peace and quiet in the United States of America. You have an answer to that one? Well, I guess you have to move to the country. You got to move to the country.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty place from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. This is the Savage Nation hoping to signify something.
Savage.
Get a job. You made me put in a buzzer stand to get me out of my bed of crime. Get a job. You wrapped a breakfast every day as you go the one and ran my way. I'm never able to say.
I don't know. Let's try something else. Play Barbara Ann for me on the Savage Nation.
Barbara Ann.
Can I tell you the story about this? I'll tell you Barbara Ann's story. Play it for a minute. I'll get 30 seconds of music, but I'm enjoying myself. Did I tell you the one about... All right, turn it on. I think I had a friend who sang in this song. I think he was in the group, the Regents. I remember we were in junior high school. He was more mature than... You ever see the kids that look like men when they were 12? There was always like somebody in the crowd. They shaved already. You know what I'm talking about. They're like 12-year-old, they had deep voices and beards. You were still prepubescent, you know, and it was, and they were always like dating 17-year-old girls. They were 13, that kind of, he was that kind of kid, but he had blonde hair, good looking boy. So he became a rock and roll singer, hit it big, went to Japan. Meanwhile, we're schlepping through geometry in the 10th grade, and he's driving around in a Jaguar with a license. And, you know, he was like on top of the world. He looked like Elvis Presley. As the years go on, and as, you know, we're moving forward into college, and I get out of college maybe 7 years later. He already had peaked. He had had one rock and roll song and another half a song and never went anywhere. Meanwhile, he was now a postman. I'm not knocking postmen, but his rock and roll career was already over, and he was a postman at Woodstock, New York. The pompadour was gone, and he's just an ordinary guy. Still a nice guy, I mean, but the Jaguar was gone. There was no longer a singing career, and he was a mailman in Woodstock. Can you imagine how life goes on? Just amazing. A lot of the guys I knew, in other words, who did very, very well young, either they peaked early or they dropped by the wayside at a certain point. But then there's the other guys who took a long time to get going, and they're actually still not even at their peak. And that's an interesting story and brings me to a question, which I'm not going to ask you because it'll throw us off the track. Which is, if you really had a choice, would you rather make it big when you're younger or when you're older? Now, it's an interesting question that if you had the choice, you don't have the choice, but if you did, let's say you had the choice to make it big when you're younger or when you're older, which would you choose? And you can't have both. In other words, you can't make it big when you're young and say that I'm going to invest it wisely and have it when I'm older. So I have to finalize the question. I have to polish it a little. If you had the choice to make it big when you're young and have nothing when you're older, or have nothing when you're young and have it big when you're older, which would you choose? That's really the question. There's a lot to be said for both because, you know, when you get older, you don't have the physical ability to enjoy it as much as when you're younger to the same extent, obviously. On the other hand, when you get older, you have a lot more needs and you're a little more fragile, and it's good to have that cushion. But meanwhile, you've missed all those years that you could have had when you were young. So on the other hand, when you're young, you can enjoy it more, particularly if you're a married guy and you have kids and you want to share it with them. But most young guys don't even think like that anymore. Who knows why I'm getting distracted? When I'm in the mood, I can do radio like no one else on earth. But, you know, like when I'm not in the mood, it's hard. You can't do it every day the same way. Some days, you know, you feel ebullient and the words just roll off your tongue and you feel great. And you could, like, roll the politics into the humor and it's a great day. And I'm in that mood today. Tomorrow will be the manic depressive thing tomorrow after the curry and no good. The curry will be a horrible day, depressed, angry, whatever.
Savage.
There's a moon out tonight. Whoa, 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 whoa. Let's go strolling. There's a girl in my
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I want to talk about something trivial. Went to a shopping mall today for lunch. I had my power lunch alone in a little restaurant. I prefer eating alone. But to make a long story short, as I'm walking down the mall, I see an ambulance, two police cars, and a fire truck at the end of the mall near a popular Italian restaurant. So naturally, I'm curious like everyone else. I go over. I see the fire truck, the ambulance, the police cars. I figured either someone had a heart attack in the restaurant or there had been an altercation. So I look and look and look, and I see a woman, African probably, not African American, but African, sitting there. And one of the EMS techs is on his knees talking to her. He's on his knees now. He's almost begging her. It's almost a posture of begging the woman. And he's filling out form after form. The police are filling out forms. The firemen are filling out forms. So I said, "This dude, something doesn't add up here. I don't know what's going on." So across the street, I see a security guard. So I start to ask him what went on. So he smiles. He says, I don't really know. And we talked. I said, one thing or another. He says, I don't know. He says, it looks crazy to me, too. So I said, where are you from? He said, Fiji. So I spoke to him in a little Fijian. I told him I'd been in villages going back in 1960s and this and that. And he said, oh, you were in the bush. I said, yeah, I collected plants. And I asked him what island he was from. And he told me Benga, the fire-walking island. And I said, I've been there. And he was very surprised. He was a young fellow. But he was also obviously new to the country. But he was smiling and he was very intelligent about America. He said to me, oh, he says, this is what goes on in Marin County. Now, Marin County is Barbara Boxer's backyard. It's where things idiotic and liberal occur on a regular basis. I said to him, do you realize how much this is costing to bring in this ambulance, these police cars, these fire trucks? I said, what happened to the woman? He said, let me find out. So he went over and he quietly spoke with her. And he came away smiling, and he said to me, she said she didn't feel well, so she called 911. I said, what? I said, it must have cost $200,000 in equipment and manpower because this person didn't feel well. She starts to laugh. He says, that's Marin County. It goes on all the time. I said, but that's why we're going broke. These people know how to abuse our country. They don't feel well, and they call 911, and they get a nice fireman on his hands and knees asking her how she feels. For fear of being sued by some rat bum from NYU, some scummy lawyer who should have been aborted as a child, because that's why the country's breaking down. It's the psychopathic communist lawyers who have twisted the police and the firemen and the entire society around their fingers. Everyone reacts for fear of a lawsuit. So we walked down the mall together, and he just said, I'm not surprised. He said, this kind of insanity goes on from the north of the county to the south. He said, it's Barbara Box's backyard. And I said, Nisan Bula, and blah, 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 and Samothe, which means peace in Fijian, and we bid our goodbye. So there it is. There's your United States of America, a nation filled with morons, on their hands and knees to legal and illegal. It doesn't matter, the cops, the firemen, the police, everybody on their hands and knees to the illegal alien, asking them how they feel. What can they possibly do for them? I got to tell you this as a side note. It's an interesting little side story. It's not as good as Charlie the as Barney the Undertaker. God, I remember those Cadillacs. There was an Undertaker. The same guy showed me my first corpse down there too. It was interesting. That, you know, I didn't put that in the book. I must have been the same age. Hot day, July, Coca-Cola, icebox outside grocery store. They call them bodegas. Then they became clubs. You fished in the bottom of the Coca-Cola box. They had ice in it that turned to water. And your arm turned blue as you fished around for a soda. That kind of day. And the Undertaker's there. My father was busy working in the back of his little shop making a lamp or cleaning. I don't know what he was doing. He wired a lot of statues into lamps. And he was busy doing that. Hot day. I'm outside. So I ask him what's going on in the mortuary down there. You know, it was a funeral parlor, but they performed embalming. They did embalming. She said, well, would you like to see what goes on? I said, okay, sure. So get in the elevator, and you get it. It was one of those elevators like in lofts where you pull a big cord from the top like a Godfather elevator they move cars on. And to this day, I can hear the hum of that elevator, the motor. And I'm going down this huge car elevator into the basement, the subterranean depths of a funeral parlor. We get down there, walk into the... And there's a doctor performing an autopsy. No, it wasn't an autopsy. Sorry, this was the embalming story. And, okay, that's it. So there it is.
Now I come back up in the street. Must have been a half an hour later. My father's in the undershirt outside the store, and he's looking for me. Hey, Mike, Michael, where? And he turns and he sees me, and when his eyes caught my eyes, he saw I was a changed person. And that's my Undertaker story.
The deep right field, that ball is going, it is gone. Maris hitting his second homer of the day. And the Yankees' sixth homer.
And there is the nostalgia setup, the Mel Allen voice, one of the greatest voices radio has ever heard, and one of the earliest radio voices that I came to love. And here I am, sitting in front of a microphone with a radio voice that millions love, now with another story that will be in my autobiography. And it's called My First Embalming, since we talked about The Undertaker, and here it is. I was now a late teenager. And I had gone to Europe, big trip to Europe, you know, hippie, beatnik trip to Europe, see the museums, blah, 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 came back on a ship. I come back from Europe and I thought I had become a little off base. It was a little kind of teenage angst, little nuts. So I took a job in a mortuary at Queens General Hospital. I remember it to this day, red brick, big smokestack, looked like a crematorium. And I go in there as an assistant to just basically mop up and sweep up in a mortuary. And I had never seen an embalming. I don't know why I took that job of all jobs. It was like a bizarre choice to begin with. I guess it proves I was a little off-based after going to Europe. But then again, I wouldn't be the first nor the last person to come back from Europe and think they were a little crazy. Just take a look at Europe. So I go down into the thing, and the guy gives me an apron and a mop. And he says, just basically your job is to mop up the floor. But meanwhile, I'm watching the autopsies. This was not this is really my first autopsy, not my first embalming. It's my first autopsy. So I watched a doctor. Now, here's a doctor with a medical degree. He was a medical examiner performing an autopsy. He has a cigar in his mouth, which I thought was weird and kind of disrespectful to the dead. The guy is chomping on a cigar. He cuts open a dead woman's head, like the top of her head, to pull back the skull cap and to remove the brains that's what an autopsy is you examine the organs. And I'll never forget it as long as I lived. She happened to have been an African-American lady and a large woman, and he was pulling and pulling and pulling, and the skull wouldn't pull off, and he puts his foot up against the gurney that she's on, or the stainless steel thing, and pulling and cursing and the cigar, and I'm mopping the kid in the room there. I couldn't believe what I'm watching. And finally, he curses, and there it comes out, and that's it. So now then I see another man. A man must have been 50, 55, white man in good shape, just slim, gray-haired, but not old-looking, dead, and he was completely naked, as you would expect, on a slab. And the kid's mopping, and I look very carefully at the corpse. And I noticed some semen on his thigh, which again was novel and unique, because I didn't understand much about death at that time, as much as I since learned. And then there was a young child, 2 or 3 years old, as beautiful as a doll. Blonde hair, blue eyes, like a doll. Still and dead. For no reason. Still and dead for no reason. I quit the next day and threw in my mop.
Savage.
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong.
People over 30 can't multitask. They can't multi-hear. They grew up doing one thing at a time. The younger generation can do multiple things at a time, but all wrong.
While our hearts were young, I'm a walking in the rain.
They're able to multitask, but they do everything wrong. They can't write a letter correctly. They can't type correctly. Nothing. I never saw anything like it. People do everything wrong, no matter what you ask people to do today. They can't get anything right, particularly if they're under 50. They can't work. They don't want to work right. I was raised in a time when the work ethic was king. I mean, you had to work. You had to work, and you had to do a good job. It was an honor. It was a mark of a person's self-respect, dignity, manhood, to be a worker and a good one. That's how I was raised. It was drummed into me from early childhood. And then you wake up and you see children. They won't clean a boat. They won't clean a house. I mean, pay them. You can't find an American kid, a white kid, to do any kind of work. They won't clean a boat. They won't clean a house. They won't babysit. They won't walk a dog. They're a bunch of spoiled drug addicts. An entire generation of children raised to think that the world owes them a living, and they walk around with a snotty attitude that I don't know where it comes from. You know, I got to be harsh about this. I watch, you know, I largely live in the suburbs. I stay in the city part-time, and I move around through many locations for obvious reasons. But a lot of my time is spent in the safe white suburbs, so to speak. I mean, let's call it like what it is. No matter how liberal they say they are, they don't want anyone around them who doesn't look like them, even though they vote lib. That's the way they are. And you watch them in their child raising, and sometimes you have to shake your head, whether it be a young mother who probably is on a prescription drug herself, and all she's obsessed with is her abs, feeding her child a jelly donut and a cocoa in the morning on her way to school, along with his Ritalin tablet, knowing nothing about diet and a child's behavior, nothing. And she doesn't want to know about it. All she wants to know is to get the brat into school so she can go have the affair or go to the exercise class for 4 hours. Whether it is a pair of white parents who are a little older than I was when I had my first child, taking a brat to a restaurant, 8, 8:30, 9, I shake my head. When do they stay home with them? When do they stay home? Don't they do homework? Isn't there a safe time to go to a restaurant where you don't have to listen to? And the crayons. Fine dining around a kid with a crayon or a coloring book? I can't even digest when they pull out the Crayolas. Why are they in the restaurant with the child with Crayolas educating them? And they always do it to show how smart they are and the child is. Last night I went to a place. It was downscale Italian. I figured I could escape it, but no, it got worse. There was a father at an adjacent table. I couldn't believe what I was listening to. I had to take the food home. I had to leave. Now, he wasn't a bad guy, don't get me wrong. But I had to listen to an entire lesson. As the children are eating, he says to them, during the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 1960s, who was president? I'm not making this up. And the children have to repeat to the father, who was the attorney on the U.S. Supreme Court? And I'm trying to eat. I couldn't even get a piece of bread down my gullet. So as I said, I packed it up and left. What is this lesson at a dinner? Why do I have to hear it to understand you're a smart, liberal man and you're intelligent and your children are as bright as you and they're going to learn to screw everyone around them when they grow up like you do for a living with your law degree? That's what you're telling me? That they're not going to be like the ordinary person. They're going to learn how to screw everybody just like daddy? Why do I have to hear this? Is there no hour when there are no children? Now, look, I love children. I raise children. But at a certain point, it seems to me it's child abuse to have them in a restaurant. So I say to myself, don't they do homework anymore? I know they don't babysit. I know they don't wash a car or a boat for a buck. They don't do chores. Do they do homework? No, unless the homework is how to put a condom on a cucumber or how to learn how racist white people are. Or to learn that marijuana is healthy for you and tobacco. I mean, tobacco is bad for you. Marijuana is healthy for you. So is there no time of day? When I raised my children, if we went into a restaurant and the kids started to make any kind of noise, I immediately picked them up and I went out of the restaurant. I talked to them. I said, look, there were other people. And even if they didn't understand me, I said to them, you can't make noise in the restaurant. There are other people eating and they want to have a nice dinner. So please, if we go back, you can't make noise. You can't make one of your famous cocktails out of the salt and the pepper and the ketchup and the mustard and the soy sauce and mix it and pass it around. No, you can't make that famous cocktail that you two like to pass around with each other because I'm liable to puke on the table. That's in the Chinese restaurants. They used to make a cocktail. Do you have any idea that that's the reason the ancient Sumerians stumbled upon beer? It was because of times like this. When you have a situation like we have today, that's why the ancient Sumerians stumbled upon beer. You know how the story goes, don't you? Well, I may as well tell it's as interesting as any, having studied this for years, all of this stuff. Our theories, no one knows. I mean, the ancient Sumerians look like my uncles to me. I mean, I see the pictures, renderings of them. I guess I descend from Sumerians because they all look like my relatives. But the way the story goes is somebody ate some grain, some type of wheat dish or whatever in the area there, the Mediterranean basin. And they spat it out. I know it's disgusting. They didn't eat it all. I was like, ugh, this is disgusting. Again, another night of grain? I'm sick of grain. I don't care how healthy they are. I don't want it. I'm a pew. Ah! And they spit it in the plate. But they were starving. Days later, they went back, and there was nothing to eat but the grain that they half-masticated and discarded in the plate. And the guy ate it. Ugh, disgusting. I ate this guy. And guess what? His wife didn't look like she had a mustache for the first time in 25 years. His ugly little children looked like he could deal with them without wanting to throw them out of the cave door. In other words, he got drunk. Why? Because the half-masticated grain matter that he spat up fermented in the cave during that period that it was sitting there, and it was produced some alcohol. And that's apparently one of the theories as to how alcoholic beverages, better known as adult beverages, developed in history. Ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, I'm glad I could share this moment with you. Another moment in Savage history on the Savage Nation. It's actually probably, according to what I've read, true. And by the way, guess which culture? You're not going to believe this one. This is a real, you're talking about historical ironies. Take a guess which ancient peoples first developed wine from the grape. Buzz, answer. The same country that's now dominated by the invader from Turkey, Iran. In other words, the ancient Persians, allegedly, or it is thought historically, were the first viticulturalists on the planet. But take a look now. You got an invader from Turkey named Ahmadinejad, who was apparently, according to Iranians, is not even of Iranian descent. He's an invader. He's like a Hun. I mean, excuse me, like a barbarian invader. Boise, Idaho, DJ, you're up on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
I'm like, I'm only 26 years old, and I can't relax in a restaurant, but what about a movie theater? Those are the worst for me. I just cringe, because right when I sit down, I see a family with five or six kids that just want to talk throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, they think it's their personal video experience in their living room. Well, in my day, we had ushers that went around with a flashlight, and they put it in your eye if you talked. It didn't always work, but, you know, we mocked the ushers, or we threw candy at them, you know. I mean, we weren't all dolls, believe me. But we knew not to talk because the other kids would have gotten into a fight with us if we talked. There was self-control because the audience would have controlled you otherwise.
Well, now I look around, and it's like I'm the only one that cares. The audience doesn't seem to care. It's like I'm weird because I'm upset that these parents want to
talk. Yeah, I can't even go to – I go to a movie very seldom. I try to go very late at night or off. You know, I went to two movies in the whole year. That's what I watch at home, you know. What do you expect in a movie theater? The lowest common denominator is in a movie theater. They're not the highest. They're not generally not working people. They're either senior citizens or looking for the senior, you know, the $5 ticket. You ever see them line up at 12:30, the Social Security crowd? You don't want to be in there after a Medicare a meal, I tell you that. You don't want to be in that because they cut back on the air conditioning. You could die in these theaters. I had it in the elevator last week, too, in the building I'm in. You don't want to go in those elevators. It's owned by some conglomerate from Boston. I'm in San Francisco. And they told the management not to put the fan on in the elevator. You could just die if you get in the wrong time of day after the seniors had visited for the medication, whatever they give them, Metamucil. I don't you know, you take your life in your hand in the elevator. What are you going to do? I don't mean when they're in there with you. I'm talking about after they get out and you get in and the elevator starts to climb. What are you going to do at that point? It's like San Quentin. It's like the gas chamber. I mean, there's nothing you could do. You're finished at that point. You got to climb, you know, a certain number of stories. You come out with your eyes smarting and gagging. But that's people today. They don't care. They don't care. What do they care if the next guy's going to come in and gag? They actually do it on purpose.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
This is the Savage Nation. Drive into the city. Go to this Chinese restaurant. Now, for one, the parking is enough to give you indigestion if you get there, and it's terrible, just awful. That already gives you indigestion. There's no point in going.
Let's go to the hop. Let's go to the hop.
Oh, baby.
Let's go to the hop.
Oh, baby.
Let's go to the hop.
So I get there. I've eaten there for 20 years, and they still mistreat us. It's just that I don't know if it's the nature of the business. They don't like me. It's racism. I don't know what it is. I can't tell. I get in there. I order a number of dishes, and I'm meeting a friend. And they bring us immediately the pot stickers and the steamed dim sum within 5 minutes. I said, well, tonight's going to be different. Now I'm three beers into the meal, and there are no dishes. And everyone who came in after me is eating. Eight times I get up, where's the food? Then they bring it out, and the rice is at the end. It was a mess, okay, a nightmare. I'm never going there again. But wait, the best is yet to come. My friend John, who's a philosophy professor, shows up a few minutes late. And he comes and he says, I had to park in a driveway around the corner. I hope I don't get a ticket. So right away, that's double anxiety. I don't blame him. There's no parking. Then he runs out 5 minutes later. And he puts a note in his windshield which says, please don't tell me. Call my cell phone number if you want me to move. Sure enough, in the middle of the meal, ring, ring. Oh, I'll be right out. I'll be right out. So I go out with him because John is a philosophy professor and he's not street smart. I just had an instinct I better be with him. Sure enough, there's a crazed Russian in the street. He had parked not only in the guy's driveway, but right against the guy's bumper. And the Russian is insanely mad, screaming and yelling. You have no brains, no brains, no brains, no brains. Stupid, stupid, stupid brain. No brains. What, you have no brains? Why are you parking my car? And he's crazy. He's livid. Now, I know how to defuse street situations. And John, the philosophy professor, doesn't know anything about this kind of interchange. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I'm trying to calm things down. I had had four beers already. So I said to him, look, tell you what, just calm down. You have no brains. No. And he's screaming and yelling the Russian, no brains, stupid. And he's in everyone's face. So I said, this could escalate, turn very bad. You know, guns, knives. You don't know what's going to crazy relatives from the Ukraine could come out with tattoos from jail. You don't know where this is going to go. I'm trying to defuse it. So I'm saying to my friend, look, back the car up. I said, if there's any damage, I will pay you. I figured money talks, right? I wasn't saying it was anyone's fault. No brains. I don't care. Damage. No brains. No brains. And he's on and on with the no brains. I said, look, my friend is a philosophy professor. I don't care. No brains. Why on my car? So I said, John, back the car up. John backs the car up, and there's no damage whatsoever. So the Russian gets down on his knees. He says, no brains, stupid. No brains anyway. I don't care. Damage, no damage. Stupid, no brains. So I said, look, is there damage? If there's damage, I'll pay. No brains, stupid. Stupid man. I said, look, is there damage? And I'm saying, John, get in the car and get out of here. I'm going to take care of it. Go. And John doesn't go. John sits there and starts in with the guy. I want to see you smile. I said, oh, my God. Now, the worst nightmare. You're telling an enraged Russian to smile? What does he think? This is a textbook in Marin County? He wants to see a smile out of an enraged Russian. He parked on his bumper. You know what that's like? That's like pulling out your private part and pressing it against his wife's jeans in the street. You know what I'm saying? You know, all right, look. I understand people expose themselves when drunk in Russia, but you don't touch wife's pants with private part. You get killed for this. It was the equivalent of, what are you parking against the guy's bumper for? It's bad enough to be in the driveway, but if you're going to park there, you don't put it on the guy's bumper. It was like a new car and little, and it looks like the guy worked all his life for his first new car. And to him, this was like a sexual encounter. It's like, all right, in my country, I know they get drunk and they pull it out, but they don't touch wife's pants. It was like on that level of insanity, the guy parked against his car. So I said, get out of here. And he's out of the car telling the guy, I want to see you smile. I figure relatives are going to come out and say, what you say to my uncle? Smile?
In Russia, the worst insult tells a man to smile when he's angry. I mean, to me, it looked like I was going to blow up into World War III. So I said to him, get in the car and get out of here. No, not here. So again, telling the guy that he didn't mean it and he wants him to smile. So I said to him, and the guy's screaming, I don't understand America. American people, stupid. Stupid American people. So I said to him, I looked him in the eye and I said, but you like America, don't you? See, I knew how to turn the situation because I know in Russia, a little bit about the Russian mind, which is that you can hate the person, but if you're a guest in another person's country, you don't hate the country because in his country, you get killed for hating someone else's country or your own country. I mean, he knows from his own reversal that through history, if you say you hated Poland and there's a Polish man in the street drunk, he'll kill you. You see, I hate you, but I like Poland. It's a strange kind of Slavic sense of humor that you have to understand how to defuse these things. He's stupid, friend, no brain. I hate Americans, stupid, don't understand them, but I love America. So it was like that kind of thing. Finally, it ended. So naturally, I'm never going to go back to that restaurant. That's all. You have to have been there. What I should have done is tape recorded this one. This would have been a beauty to have on tape recording.
Savage.
Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Indonesian woman jailed for almost cutting off her husband's penis over jealousy. A Malaysian court sentenced an Indonesian woman to prison for 6 months for almost severing her husband's penis out of jealousy, police said Wednesday. Umadat Setu, an Indonesian migrant worker living in Malaysia, pled guilty to court. Blah, 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 blah. Umada, a 47-year-old canteen operator, was arrested Sunday after her husband, who was also from Indonesia, filed a police report claiming she tried to cut off his penis with a knife. He received 11 stitches, blah, blah, blah. Muslim men in Malaysia are allowed to take up to four wives. It was not clear if Umida will... Four wives in Malaysia on the Muslim law? So what are they persecuting that poor guy in Utah for? I mean, he could have used the cultural defense if he wanted to. The dispute surfaced because Umida was jealous of another woman. Blah, 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 blah. Well, the guy's lucky that it occurred in Indonesia, not in Burma. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I'm so young and you're so old. This, my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh, please stay by me, Diana.
Chicago, Illinois. Fred, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you wrote a book saying that liberalism is a mental disease, and yet you've just vindicated everything they've said for the past decades since Vietnam. Everything you've said is what the liberals have been saying for decades. This war.
So in other words, what? What are the liberals saying now, Fred, that makes them so brilliant?
What are they saying now? Well, so far is everything that you've said so far and everything that you've
said. Fred, please, you know, you're speaking in code words. What are liberals saying about Afghanistan now that you agree with so we can understand what you're saying?
We should get out. That's what they're saying.
Just we should get out. So why did Obama say we should get in?
Huh?
You heard me. Don't suddenly go half deaf on me. You just said liberals said we should get out. Obama said we should get in. So is he not a liberal?
I don't know if he's a liberal. I'm telling you what the liberal movement, the people who voted him in, wanted to get out of the war. That was one of the primary reasons we voted him in. The fact that he's turned his back on them, that's not unusual for any politician.
So how would the liberals, since you consider yourself one of them, and that's fine by me as long as you're willing to discuss your viewpoint, how would you face off a radical Islamic enemy that will not compromise, that will either kill you or convert you? How would you deal with them?
Well, the only way we could deal with them is to defend ourselves against them, which doesn't necessarily mean war. The thing is to step up our home, to say the things we've already done, step up our home defense, make sure our airports and everything is are guarded. How can you stop an idea? You can't stop it with a bullet. They're determined to kill us. The only thing you can do is defend yourself any way you can.
But let me ask you, Fred, rationally, do you think there is an Islamic a militant Islamic threat against this country and against the West?
Oh, yeah, there is. Terrible, hard feelings against us by radical Islamist groups. Yeah, they hate us.
Okay, so your idea is to withdraw the military and face them here through the FBI, through Homeland Security, but not to go to war with them anywhere.
if I thought the war would work, I would go to war. But it's like you said, it doesn't seem to be that a war is going to work. If you could show me where a war works.
Well, it's interesting to me that that leftists like yourself actually agree with me on this, which is not unexpected, because I predicted a few months ago that there would be an anti-war movement in America, but I also said it would be led by the right rather than the left, because it was the right now for quite a while that's been saying no to this war. It doesn't matter who began it, who ended it. What matters is that the military-industrial complex is behind it. I think we could agree on that as well, Fred, correct?
You bet. It is. It is. I agree with you.
Well, all right. All I can say is, Fred, I appreciate you listening so carefully. I disagree with you on some points. On others, we agree. Now, this is very intriguing, ladies and gentlemen. Something just happened on this radio show that is historic in the history of radio. And I knew this day would come. I knew the day would come when the two ends of the political spectrum would suddenly see that they're saying the same thing on so many issues. Now, let's start with the most important issue there is, and that's life and death. Life and death issues are what we're talking about. This is not about making points on Obama, making points against Republicans, making points against liberals, or making points against conservatives. It is your neighbor's son who is going to go over there and be butchered to death in Afghanistan if he's caught by these animals. Let's make no mistake about it. What they did to the Russians, you still don't know. You still don't know what they did to the Russian boys that they caught, the 18-year-old blonde boys with blue eyes, the kind of tortures that they were subjected to. You're dealing with medieval throwbacks. They do not respect the Geneva Convention. They do not respect any convention. They respect only one thing, and that's a bullet. And they have a lot of them. They're being supplied by Iran and God knows who else. We have heavy equipment. We have heavy weapons, such as the Air Force, missiles. We're not going to use them. So already strategically, they have the advantage because they know the terrain. Let me repeat that. You don't have to be an armchair general to understand that I just made eminently good sense. What is our military advantage in? It's in hardware. It's in technology. So if you can't use the hardware and the technology in the form of cruise missiles, in the form of bunker-busting bombs, in the form of F-18 Hornets and the best trained pilots in the world, we have eight or nine aircraft carriers. I was aboard one 2 years ago. Doesn't make me an expert. I was impressed to find out that every one of our aircraft carriers has an air force on it larger than most nations on Earth. I didn't know that. In other words, the strike capacity of any aircraft carrier that the U.S. has is more powerful than the air force of most nations on Earth, single aircraft carrier. And we have them all over the world. Yet we will not be using our aircraft carriers in Afghanistan, will we? Now, why? Well, the why is the interesting part. Again, I want you to go back to geography. You know what the Himalayas are. You heard of Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth. The foothills of the Himalayas happen to begin on that side of the Earth in Afghanistan. They slowly climb up to those cloud levels in India. So how are our men going to fight in these deep canyons that have sucked entire brigades that have never been seen again? Russian brigades have gone in there and never came out of these mountain passes. Do I have to tell you about the Khyber Pass? Shall we read some poetry from the British colonial days? Look, you don't have to be a genius to understand this is not a flat plain war where you can enlist 1,000 tanks. It's a different form of warfare. That is why the enemy is so deeply rooted in that area. So that leaves us with very few options other than to put boots on the ground, so to speak. Although I don't like that phrase, it's not boots on the ground. It's Mrs. Smith's son on the ground. Do we have enough men trained in mountain warfare to go out there? He may say 30,000 men. Well, how many of those 30,000 men are trained in high altitude fighting? How many of those men are as endurance capable as the enemy who grew up in those mountains? We didn't hear any of that. I doubt that we will. So why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we in Afghanistan? I've been asking the question for a long time now. I don't have the answer for you. I keep hearing that if we don't defeat them there, it's going to create a vacuum into which Al-Qaeda and the other terrorist organizations will have a war cry. They'll come from around the world, and they will have a home base. Well, maybe that is true, but maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea. Now, why do I say that? Because if they would all coalesce in Afghanistan, at least we could enlist our air force, our cruise missiles, we could unleash the arsenal that we have on all of the terrorists on Earth when they go to celebrate in their new homeland of Afghanistan. So I don't know that this policy is going to work to the detriment of Al-Qaeda. I think, in fact, it's going to encourage Al-Qaeda to keep sucking our young men into the meat grinder. Savage Nation, sitting here with a bestseller, thanks to you. Jimmy Carter schlepping around the country like, well, a bad venue to another, still can't get out of the starting gate with his book. No one knows, never heard of him. It's amazing the real Americans can find the real book when they really want it. And here in the city of San Francisco, they have a World Series playoff. I lasted two innings. I'm not a sports fan. Some are, including some very intelligent people in my own family. I'm not. Two innings, I was out of there. Like St. Vitus dance, I ran out of the chair, ran to the ferry and got out of the city. So now I can't even come into town. The lunacy that's in the streets. And over there in the Nut House up in Napa, the mental hospital, a state mental hospital worker was robbed and strangled by an inmate. Charlie Sheen, New York, found running naked, allegedly, in the lobby of a hotel with drugs and a hooker. His spokesmouth said that it was an allergic reaction. It's great working in the media. I mean, who else would read this? I have to do this for a living, so you pass everything. Jimmy Carter as a writer. That's as interesting as Charlie Sheen as someone with an allergy. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Where are you, little star?
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
My father was an immigrant. Yeah, he came here when he was 13 or 7. I don't even know. He was not born here. I was born here. And he was a citizen when I was born here. I'm not an anchor baby. Don't get me wrong. I'm not an anchor baby, but I have one foot in the old world and one foot in the new world. So I really speak from, let's say, a knowledgeable position about it. I understand what it's like to live in a poor household with many people. Trust me, we lived in a place, we didn't even have a bedroom in the Bronx. And I think about it. There was one bedroom and there was a tiny living room with a fake fireplace. And I remember we hung fake stockings on the fake fireplace. I thought Santa would give me a gift. So, you know, part in the old world, part in the new world. My grandmother didn't speak a word of English in the house. She spoke the old languages from the old country. I couldn't believe, I'm thinking about it now. And she was so wonderful. Oh, did I love her. God, did I love that woman. She was so beautiful. Very stoic. Very, very Russian, this woman. She spoke to me in Russian, by the way. I don't think you know that. I never told you that. I am not a Russian language speaker, but it's strange. I can understand the language to a certain extent. And it's a very hard language for an American to learn, incidentally. It's not an easy language. The alphabet's very complicated for an English speaker. I can just imagine how hard English is to learn for a Spanish speaker, by the way. It's not an English. English is a tough language, incidentally. Very tough. But in my home, my parents spoke only English. So to make a long story short, here I am, man-child in the promised land. And when my turn came to assume my mantle in this country and my chosen profession, they said white men need not apply. The positions are closed. So you can understand where I was coming from. So to make a long story short, I cut a Virgin demo in 1993, and I send it out to about 220 radio stations. I get a return from about 5 to 10 of them. And 5 of them say, that's really good stuff. Would you like to work on our station? I remember to this day, one of them was in Boston, of all places. I don't remember the station that said, we like what you did. But nevertheless, I was living in San Francisco, as I am now, and one of them came from a local station, and the guy says to me, good stuff, would you like to come on in and talk to us? And then they gave me a fill-in. Well, anyway, here's the Virgin demo, 1993, Savage's Virgin demo, play 01.
And now, direct from the towers above Manhattan, it's the Michael Savage Show. To the right of Rush and to the left of God, and now Michael Savage.
See, I'm glad I can be with you 7 nights a week because these stories are just not going away. I mean, every day in every way we're getting assaulted. Look at these questions before us today. Look at the questions before us. You know, they say that I'm to the right of Rush and to the left of God. I really don't think that that's funny. I really don't think that's funny at all. Do immigrants carry diseases? Are lawyers really humans? Is white bread safe to eat? How come women with mustaches, with peace and love and turtle-saving bumper stickers, are the most likely to cut you off on the highway? Is Bill Clinton's mother a lesbian? By the way, a quick note. Nazis, skinheads, KKK, don't call me. Crawl back into your bunkers. You've given true conservatives a bad name because you permit the sick leftists to paint all conservatives with the fascist brush, okay? Don't call me. Do Labor Secretary Reich's feet touch the ground when he's seated on talk shows? I don't know. But these are some of the questions that I think we have to answer here. Because
all right, let's pause. You see how daring this was? Do you see how good? Now you say, well, it's commonplace today. It was not commonplace in 1994, by the way. It was really daring. It broke open new ground. I changed the media landscape. And that's it. That's how I started. Then I did a show. I'll never forget it. I'm going to just tell you the story, and then we're going to move on. I'll never forget it. So the local station manager calls me, and he says, would you like to fill in? I said, sure, I'll try it. Now, I had never done radio except on book tours. I had done 10 national book tours where you go around and do radio and television. They were very stressful. But along the way, I remember various program directors had said to me, you know, you're really good on the radio. You should consider a career in radio. I had no way. How could you get a job in radio? It was as real to me as becoming an astronaut. Of course I wanted to do it. But I didn't know. How would you get into radio? It seemed as difficult as becoming an astronaut. I had no way to do it. So let me put it to you that way. But let me tell you something. Desperation breeds creativity, and creativity breeds you take a lot of chances. And I think that fate had a hand in this and God. I think I really was set out to do this from the beginning. All right, so he says fill in. All right, the first show I fill in for is on a liberal talk station in San Francisco. It's still there. It's a powerhouse, 50,000 water. And he gives me a show to fill in for that a guy is on the overnight show, and he's a hater of the lowest order, hates white people, panders to the most, let's say a Reverend Wright type, as exactly a Reverend Wright, all night long hate radio against whites, against America. He himself, of course, is living the high life, as is Reverend Wright in his $10 million house. You understand how it works. Curse America and go and laugh all the way to the bank, you know. Yeah. All they needed was the Kool-Aid, like a Jim Jones job. So that's the kind of show I didn't know, really. I never listened to the Cretan. I'm never up in the middle of the night. So he said, all right, I go on the air, and I start to tell about illegal immigrants and this and that. I get hate callers like I have never encountered in my life. Because remember what my last incarnation was. I was the good doctor. I was the nutritionist and the herbalist who gave lectures around the world. And by the way, I had even given a lecture on, you'll never believe this story. I don't think I've told it. Normally, I would give lectures about health and vitamins and nutrition in America. At one point, I was director of nutrition for a major international nutrition company. They sent me to Malaysia to talk about their products. My audience were all Muslim women. So I go into the audience. I could not believe it. They were all Muslim women. They were a great audience. These were moderate Muslim women who were interested in nutritional supplements. They received it very well. I spoke, and it was translated. So I had been all over the world doing lectures, and I was usually very well received, and frankly, I was the beloved doctor kind of thing. Now I do talk radio, and I walk into a propeller of hatred from the left. I never encountered such hatred from the people that were the regular listeners of this guy's show. That night at 5 in the morning when the shift ended, remember what it was? I think it was 1 to 5 in the morning. I don't remember. I drive home from that station. The whole way home, I'm like in a paranoid state. I'm looking in the rearview mirrors. I thought I was being followed. I get home. The next day, I say to my family when I got home, when they woke up, I said, I'm never going to do radio as long as I live. I said, I can't take the hatred of the callers. The liberals are the most hateful people I've ever encountered in the world. I said, no amount of money on earth would be worth doing this. I called the station. Actually, they called me the next day when I woke up, and they said, wow, you did a great job, Savage. Would you like to fill in again? I said, no, I would never fill in again as long as I live. I don't want to ever do radio again. Ask them. I'm not making it up. I said, well, they said, why? I said, I'm not going to go into a show like that again with these haters. They said, well, how about filling in during the day? I said, I don't know. I don't think I could do radio again. It's too hateful.
the people who call it are full of hate, the left-wingers. Well, they said, okay, I tell you what, you won't have to do a night shift again. You'll do a day shift. And then, I swear, then I did a little fill-in on the day, and I shook up the whole local media. Then eventually they created a local conservative station, and I went on that. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Remember, I had a fairly good living. I was making a good living as an author and as a consultant, and I didn't want anything to do with radio, but the temptation was too great. And I got to tell you something else. Radio, you ask anyone in the media who knows how to do it right, they'll all tell you the same thing. Nothing in the world of media can compare to the high you get off radio. There's nothing that can compare to the feelings you get when you do this right. There's no performance in the world that equals radio. I don't care what you do for a living. Look, I wrote books. I'm not a Dostoevsky. I didn't write fiction, but I wrote really fine nonfiction. My nonfiction were all Persian miniatures. They're excellent. In fact, my first book, Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, is still in print. I wrote books to last. They were not just fluff. I was a craftsman as a writer. However, writing is a very difficult profession because it takes a year to conceive of a book, 2 years to write a book, till it comes out is like another 9 months. By the time it's out, you're not connected to the product anymore, to the work. There's no immediate feedback. And here's an interesting side note. I had an editor at Houghton Mifflin in Boston when I wrote A Maximum Immunity, a book that went into six different languages. It was a great book, by the way. It's still around. I mean, maybe it's a little out of date in some ways, but in terms of describing the immune system, it's a very good book. The editor, who was a really high-class old Bostonian, took me to lunch in one of the great Boston restaurants, and she said to me, you know, you really are made for radio more so than you are for writing. I said, are you insulting me? She said, no, listen to what I'm saying. She said, you're a guy who's got so much energy, and you're so immediate, and you can deliver an idea immediately from the top of your head perfectly. She said, you need immediate feedback. She said, you can't get that from writing. She's absolutely right. So there's nothing like radio. It's like riding a horse bareback. I don't know how else to put it. It's like speeding across a plain on a horse without a saddle. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Other forms of media are like riding a trotters at Yonkers. You've got a three-wheeled vehicle underneath you and a horse and a bridle. Or some may approach, let's say, riding in another manner. But there's nothing like riding a horse across the plains without a saddle while firing a bow and arrow. That's radio.
Savage.
'Cause you've got
personality,
walk
with personality,
talk
with personality,
smile
with personality,
charm
with personality,
love
with personality,
and plus you got a great big heart. So
no one uses certain words. Nobody uses anymore, like haberdashery. Well, I'm even wouldn't even go in. It sounds like it's something to do with plants. Haberdashery. Let's think of some other antiquated phrases that are no longer used at all, you know, like big words. I like big words, you know. There are uses for big words if they actually apply. Even if you're a man of the people, you should use them when they're the best word. You don't have to use four words for one if the one word is better than the four, said the fool. Huckleberry Finn needs music right now in order to keep going. Huckleberry needs... Wait a minute, stop. No, no, no. Didn't you get me Offenbach for today? You said you had Offenbach. Where is it? That's what I'm talking about. Now you're talking. I wish I'd been born in 1870. I would like to have been a cohort of Toulouse-Lautrec. Nice, different age. Gas lamp era. Prior to that nasty Edison. It's not exactly what I want. Do you have the Follies Bergère, or is this it? No, 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 no. That's some simpy New York. That's close, 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 closer. I see the Can-Can girls and the Garters and all of the drunk Frenchmen in the audience. Da, 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 da. Come on, who doesn't love this? An innocent time in the world. The War of 1812 was over. The U.S. Civil War was over. Everybody knows this, right? Can't you just see them on the stage dancing? This is pre-electricity, isn't it, guys? It's a different era. There were no problems like today. Nothing. Different world. All right, and I made my point. Sometimes I drift off in reveries, and I used to dream, and people used to say to me, if you could be born any time, where would you like to be born? I hope God's not listening, because he's liable to say, all right, I heard that. I was listening to your show. I had nothing to do with it. What happens the day I go to, like, to heaven, and God says, I was listening. Didn't you say that you wanted to be born in 1870? No, I'm just kidding, God. Well, no, I take you seriously. I mean, you think you're so important. So you're going to be reborn in 1870 in France. No, please. I don't want to eat rotten cheese. Please. I don't want to live in a place where there's no hot running water. And although I like garlic, God, I don't want to be around everybody else who has garlic breath, if you don't mind. There was no mouthwash in those days. I could turn it into a show topic. When would you like to be reborn? You know, if you could pick it, what would it be? I just always liked that period. I even liked the art of that period. All of the Impressionists were painting around then. I mean, through certainly 30 years and more beyond that, but that's about when it began. If my Art 101 memory, is still operational. The Savage Nation broadcasting from San Francisco to the world. One man's opinion is what it is. One man's opinion, that's all. Just my opinion. I try to back it up with facts. You don't want to read the facts, I can't help you. The beauty of the show is that I disseminate the information, the stories, whatever. I combine it with some folksy stories, which are all real. And then you can go to my website and you can look up the actual article. I don't write the articles. I link them. So I love the 50s when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. Let's play some rock and roll. That's all. So we had a president that we knew we could trust. We weren't, wondering which side he was on. General Dwight D. Eisenhower. We knew which side he was on. That's all. This one, you don't know which side he's on. How did we elect this guy? No background. Zero. I guess Rahm Emanuel and Axelrod decided to make him the president with money from George Soros and others. And look what we have now. All right, whatever. I went up at the best single shot camera around. I'm looking at a Canon. I have a Sony. I think I'm going to get a Canon. I have a cousin who is a photographer. He told me that's the best. Then I stopped at the Ferrari dealer. Not the dealer. I like going into service bays for Ferrari. It's like a model shop. Said hello to the guys, and I said, can I see the Ferrari California? It's a nice car, really is, 20-inch wheels. It could actually go up driveways without bottoming out. Surprisingly doing well, the Ferrari business. You wouldn't understand this. I mean, there's unemployment, but I don't know who's buying them.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I saved my pennies and I saved my dimes. Giddy up, 409. For I knew there would be a time. Giddy up, 409. When I would buy a brand new 409.
Here is a segment of America. Mansions are selling again. I predicted it. See, this is the problem that you liberals don't understand. You'll never understand. Leftists don't understand this. They think that because the Democrats took office and they started to feed at the trough, that the money would trickle down to the people. I predicted last year that the very same luxury items that were selling when the Republicans were in power would sell again. And I was right. Big beach homes are selling in the $20 million range in Florida again. Ferraris are selling again.
When I take her to the track, she really shines.
Private jets are selling again. So in other words, it doesn't matter which party's in power. Some are going to feed at the troughs and some are going to buy the very same items again. It doesn't really matter. And that's the good news. That is the good news. And I'm all for it. I like a certain amount of greed and corruption. I think it's very healthy for society. What I don't like is incompetence when it comes to national security. If you were to say to me, what is the most important thing in a political party? Number one, national security. Number two, the economy. The rest is more or less a gibberish of the same. Yes, they differ on social issues a little bit here and a little bit there, but by and large, it's the same mess. So, you know, I'm not that excited about it all. He has failed us completely on the level of national security. His own intelligence guy said they have two strikes and they don't want a third. But for most Americans, Obama's already had the third strike. They don't trust him on national security. That's all. All right, how about some more of the new rock and roll that we have?
Oh, darling.
This is the Savage Nation.
I had a girl, Donna was her name. Said she left me.
So, now that I've said it all, good night and good luck. I'm leaving.
Savage.